Hi, everyone. My name is Erin Rankin, and I'm here with my partner, Nicole Avrin-Wiest.
Hello, Erin.
Hi, Nicole. Thanks for joining us for episode 3 of It All Adds Up, Kroll and Mooring's Government Contracts, Cost, and Pricing podcast. Nicole, in our last episode, you talked a little bit about how cost and pricing issues permeate every aspect of government contracts. And so we thought today it would be a good idea to take a little bit of a deeper dive into a framework of the fundamentals of cost and pricing. What is the purpose of all of these complicated rules? I mean, we've got TINA, we've got FAR Part 15, we've got FAR Part 31, we've got the cost accounting standards, we've got FAR Part 30, which implement and administer the cost accounting standards. Why is all of this necessary, and what are we trying to accomplish here?
Great question. Lots of questions in there. We also have FAR Part 12 pertaining to commercial items, but those, as we'll talk about here in a minute, are reflected to a large degree in FAR 15.4, which is the section of FAR Part 15 that talks about cost and price analysis techniques. Ultimately, you know, at bottom, these rules, which are not intuitive, can be very nuanced and are really going to depend on the nature of the procurement, the contract type, the status of the contractor with respect to whether they have contracts covered by CAS or TINA, et cetera. At the end of the day, a primary goal is to get to an agreement between the parties, the buyer, the government, the seller, the contractor, to get an agreement on a fair and reasonable price. At the end of the day, that's what we're trying to accomplish. Embedded in these rules, there are government policies. So the government has waived their sovereign immunity when they engage as a contracting party. And it's good to be the king. So if I'm going to do that, and I'm going to engage in contracts with you as the seller, I get to make the rules. And the rules are going to help both establish a fair and reasonable price for both of us, but they're also going to a certain degree, implement policies that I have as the buyer. I have the purse, and if I don't want to reimburse for certain kinds of costs, let's say alcohol, you can incur those costs, but I'm not going to reimburse you for them.
You know, that's a really good point, Nicole, because in the commercial marketplace, often buyers and sellers can get fair and reasonable prices, right? Because there's competition. And so you raise a good point about why the government needs or wants to have all of these complex rules around reaching or achieving that fair and reasonable price.
And I would add to that, Erin, and we'll get into the details of this in, you know, this episode and the next few episodes. But even in the commercial item space of government contracting, or now commercial products and services, as those terms are defined under FAR 2.101, used to be defined as commercial item. As we know, that definition got split up a few years ago, or last year, can't remember, but recently, substantively the same. If I talk about commercial items, it's the same as products and services. But even when we're dealing with what is definitionally a commercial product and service, the government has special rules for setting the fair and reasonable price for commercial products and services that, again, some would argue are inconsistent with how we do business with each other in the private marketplace. So maybe a good place to start, Erin, would be to start with, again, at least one set of rules that govern cost and pricing, and that is in FAR 15.4, which is a section of the Federal Acquisition Regulation that talks about the objectives of getting to a fair and reasonable price and how the government and contractors as a seller can get to agreement on a final price that is fair and reasonable to both parties. That subsection in FAR 15.4 has a number of cost and price analysis techniques and procedures that can be used to get to that fair and reasonable price agreement. Those techniques and tools Some are easier maybe to implement, again, depending on the nature of the particular products or services that are being procured, the marketplace, the availability of the products and services to non-government buyers for non-governmental purposes. But we'll see, you know, fundamentally, if we're talking about a commercial product and service, the preferential tool is, and there's a hierarchy of these price analysis techniques, is to do what's called a price analysis. So we're not going to look at, in the first instance, cost data. There may not be cost data underlying a price. Again, to your point, Aaron, I'm in the commercial marketplace. I'm offering to sell it to you, Aaron, and I might assign a value to that product or service that is not directly tied at all to what my costs are to make or deliver that cost product or that product.
Right. And if I'm the buyer and I don't like the price that you're offering, I might go next door and buy it from someone who's selling at a lower price, if price is the most important factor to me, right?
And assuming there are enough other sellers of that same or similar product or service to have those options. So that's where we'll start to get into some of the nuances here with respect to commercial pricing. But again, starting back, some of these price analysis techniques are comparing the proposed price received in response to the solicitation, let's assume it's competitive, to other prices that are offered. So in the first instance, adequate price competition is the primary way that a buyer can ensure itself of getting a fair and reasonable price. To your point, Aaron, if I have multiple bidders, two or more competing independently, presumably you as the seller are going to set a price that you think is competitive because you want to win the competition.
Yep.
So presumably all of those sellers are going to set prices that are designed to win the competition, assuming they want to win the competition, right? And so comparison of those prices, by definition, adequate price competition ensures fair and reasonable pricing. The buyer, the government here, doesn't need any more information, doesn't need to do anything else to ensure that the price is fair and reasonable when it has adequate price competition.
Right. And another option for the government when there is competition or when there are similar items or services sold in the marketplace is to look at price lists, right, that are published. The government can go on the internet just like we can and see what other companies are selling the same or similar products or services for and compare that to the prices that they're being offered to determine that, okay, if I can get it for a similar price from this company and another company is offering it for a lower price, then maybe that's a fair and reasonable price.
And if there are differences between those two products, right, your product has a few different bells and whistles, or your service offering has a few additional value-added components than mine, right? Does that nullify, Aaron, the price comparison? How do those factors affect the price comparison in that type of situation?
Well, it's just like you and me going to the store to buy a new outfit, right? Maybe I'll pay more for a higher quality material. Maybe I won't. It just depends on what the purpose is of what I'm buying, right? And do I have the money to spend more? So those are all really interesting analyses or techniques. Another one that the government can use is they can compare prices that are being proposed to prices they've paid in the past, right? For same or similar products or services, which again is another technique that we all use in our daily lives when shopping.
Yeah. And, you know, the government, as I don't know if this is actually accurate, but I would say they're probably the largest buyer of goods and services, right? They buy everything from toilet paper to fighter jets and you know, missiles and the like. So they're buying absolutely everything in the spectrum. And that pricing information, while it may not be conveniently aggregated into a single central repository available to each and every buyer within the federal government, and I used air quotes around that, they do have, right? The government has historical information about prices paid. So my understanding is as well is that DOD is building capabilities, developing capabilities to better access, manage, organize, may use some AI types of techniques to isolate, identify that historical pricing information. Because again, you've got the information, and it's valuable information to help assess the prices that are being proposed today to what the government, maybe some other departments within DOD or non-DOD agencies might have paid for something similar, or maybe the exact same thing from the same seller.
So why don't we talk about some techniques that maybe are less intuitive or less like what people do in their day-to-day lives when they're comparison shopping, for example, or thinking about what they paid last year for the same item. Another technique the government used is independent government cost estimates. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah. So independent government cost estimates should cost, oftentimes agencies in their acquisition planning for a procurement, they will do their own estimates of what it's going to cost the government, what it should cost the government, so that they have a basis as part of their overall planning for the procurement, for the program, of what it's going to cost and what they should expect it to cost. And they have their assumptions that they've baked into that. You know, I'm anticipating X number lines of code will have to be developed as part of what I'm asking the contractor to deliver. And here is the information that I have on what I think software of this complexity type, et cetera, should cost. And I will compare what I think it should cost and the estimate that I developed as part of the government cost estimate to what I'm getting from the offeror. To the extent there are differences, those might be informed by the different assumptions, and maybe different technical approaches were being assumed by the government versus the contractor. That can also help inform disconnects, possible disconnects. Are we aligned on our thinking on what the work is, the scope of work? You and I do this every day when we have to talk with our clients about budgets for new matters, for example. What do we think it's going to cost? And so getting aligned on the assumptions that we're both looking at and what we think it's going to take, and then using that, your estimate, and comparing it to mine, how close are we? And ultimately, that's another technique alone or in combination with some of these other techniques that could help us get to what we think is a fair and reasonable price.
And FAR 15.4 also talks about parametric estimating methods. What is that?
So this might be more of a technical topic for another episode when we can actually get those parametric estimators in here to talk about it.
That's a good idea.
Yes, it is. There are a number of estimating techniques, and I won't attempt to define it precisely here. But there are a number of other estimating techniques that can be developed that the government can use to help look at that. I would say my awareness of the use of government parametric estimating techniques really been limited to some major procurements in the context of, you know, an evaluation. So my visibility into that was really through bid protest work and looking at how the estimates were developed.
And finally, and we're going to talk more about this in the next episode, but just to tee it up, the government may also either require or request that the contractor provide cost or pricing data. Sometimes that data has to be certified. So if the procurement is subject to TINA, or Truthful Cost or Pricing Data Statute, and sometimes the government just asks nicely for cost or pricing data, but they don't require or can't require the contractor to certify it.
Yeah. And sometimes they ask maybe not so nicely. You know, we started the conversation, Aaron, with, I think, some basic assumptions that the products or services might be available in the commercial marketplace, whether as an offering of that particular contractor or by others in the market. And we can just compare prices and do that analysis. But what happens when the government perceives a lack of sufficient buyers within that marketplace other than the government? Well, the rules under 15.4 allow the government to request or require the submission of cost or pricing data to help inform its evaluation of fair and reasonable pricing. That is not necessarily intuitive. It's not always easy for folks to identify what that cost or pricing data may be. Do they have it? In what form? Is it a form that the government is used to seeing? So it can get a little complicated, and we can talk about that cost analysis. That then takes it from a price analysis focus to a cost analysis focus when cost data are being provided. And we'll talk more about that in the next episode.
Well, really looking forward to the next episode then, Nicole. And it's been great chatting with you as always. Hope you tune in next time.
Thanks, Erin.
This episode of It All Adds Up is brought to you by Kroll & Mooring LLP. To learn more about this series, visit kroll.com/podcasts.